you're on the front porch. This week, the circus is coming back to Charleston, and I'm not just talking about Barnum and Bailey. We'll talk about the special session with Brad McElhaney, statewide correspondent for West Virginia Metro News, about our colorful governor, the budget showdown, and whether we'll ever get back to normal at the legislature again. Support for the Front Porch comes from the Charleston Gazette Mail and its CGM app. Download it for the latest news, traffic, weather, and more. I'm Laurie Lynn, and along with co-host Rick Wilson, our other host, Scott Finn, is still sleeping off the latest fun drive. But here with us is Brad McElhaney. Brad, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
We have the legislature coming back into session this week at the call of Governor Jim Justice.
The overview is that we find ourselves in this situation for the second year in a row, trying to cobble together some sort of state budget, which is constitutionally mandated during the legislative session. So now we're going into overtime. And the players are different, and they're really interesting players. The governor is a very successful man by any stretch of the imagination, used to getting his way, has ambition for the state. The Senate president is new. Last year it was Bill Cole. This year Mitch Carmichael is in that role, and he is a high-energy, enthusiastic guy. And over in the House, you've got Speaker Tim Armstead, who's been in that role now for a couple of years. So the players are different, but the situation is very similar. And the dynamic that's happening is the governor has these ambitions for the state. He would call it investing. The House largely is made up of members who believe they were voted into office to maintain or reduce a level of spending of the government. So their ambition is to be less ambitious in terms of the role of the government. And they all feel like they're fulfilling their roles here. I don't think there's any disingenuity out of anyone, but the dynamic is we're having trouble agreeing second year in a row.
Ever since the last night of the regular session, when we had that kind of dramatic moment where there was this potential compromise that had been agreed to by Mitch Carmichael and Jim Justice, and then you had all the House members saying, wait, we haven't even heard about this. And then there was this kind of two-week period where the House was saying the governor won't talk to us. Now it looks like he is talking to them. Are there lingering bad feelings there on the part of the House? It seems like a lot of the rhetoric that I'm seeing from the House is a little bit stronger than it usually is. It's a little bit more intransigent, if you will.
Well, that two-week period was punctuated by the governor making a grand gesture with the budget that involved the excrement of a bovine creature. So that was the message they heard, and almost the only message they heard throughout that period. Besides that, it was a weird role reversal. The House actually had been directly negotiating with the governor's office during the session because they thought that there was some common ground in their approaches, and the Senate was left out in that case. And then the last night of the session, there was a complete switch, and the governor revealed that he'd been working at least that day and maybe before that with President Carmichael. And it really just caught the House off guard. It wasn't that they felt that there shouldn't be that kind of negotiation, but it was learning about it at 10 o'clock. You can talk all you want about the policy at play here, but certainly the personalities that are involved, you can't have negotiations without personalities, and they're strained.
I think we could also say that the governor's press conference probably raised the bar on any and all future use of props at a news event. I saw some interesting comment that the House apparently did not share some of the Senate's enthusiasm for cutting the income tax.
Yeah, it's the balancing act that you have to do on the math. The Senate leadership, the majority, really believes that lowering the income tax would spur economic activity. The House majority follows that logic. They're not against that. But to balance the budget, you've got to raise the state sales tax by a percentage, and particularly delegates who live along border counties are worried about what that would do to your mom-and-pop shops in their districts.
Just to talk about potential specifics of this potential deal, we have maybe a raise in the sales tax, which you just mentioned, maybe a lowering to a potential eventually phasing out of the income tax, monkeying around with the severance tax, which has some people in the coal industry upset, some people not upset. What is the constituency for this? You're angering the conservatives by raising taxes at all. And some people in the House just will not vote for any kind of tax increase. Progressives are upset because the way that we're raising taxes is regressive, arguably. You have the border folks upset. You have some of the coal people upset. Who is going to really take ownership of this and force it through?
Yeah, so there's a constituency in the Senate in the sense that the Senate majority is very enthusiastic about this income tax plan. And when their leader, Senate President Carmichael, talks about it, that enthusiasm comes out. So I don't have a lot of doubt that the Senate is going to embrace this largely. And there are other taxes possibly increasing, the corporate net income tax, gas tax to pay for highways, and that's part of the governor's ambition. But when the House is a whole different ballgame, and there's just more delegates. There's 100. Because the plan is so multifaceted, each of them may have aspects that they really question, whether it's Republicans wondering about an increase in the sales tax or whether it's Democrats wondering about the regressive nature of lowering the income tax.
Well, as you reported, the tax department estimate shows the Senate plan would take like $220 million out of the budget in the future, right, due to reductions in the income tax. So, and that would just show that we would be back in sort of permanent crisis mode in the years go by, too. That was pretty much what Mark Mukow suggested when he did his analysis.
Yeah, so buying into either the governor's interpretation of this plan or the Senate leadership's interpretation of this plan requires something of a leap of faith. The governor will tell you that his highways plan, which is potentially the investment of millions of dollars in West Virginia highways, is going to put people to work. He says his math is 48,000 people going to work, thus generating their own tax base. The Senate's proposal is we're going to lower the income tax, and that's going to spur economic activity, and we're going to bring business in, and they're all going to pay taxes. But it's a lot of ifs. You'd like to think that there's going to be this kind of economic incentive, but you got to decide whether you believe it.
How ready do you think this governor is to compromise? He comes from a business background where I think we think of business deals, as being compromised. But I wonder if his experience of deal making is kind of take it or leave it sort of negotiation, because that seems to be almost the way he wants to approach this. Do you think it's in him to really just the way that he talks about this? It really just does. You get a my way or the highway kind of feeling from him.
Yeah, and it's just different with a business deal. If he had decided he didn't want to buy the Greenbrier at one point, you walk away from the deal. There's no deadline. You don't have to buy the Greenbrier by July. In this case, there's no walking away from the deal. You got to do something, I think, unless we all want to plummet into the chaos of not having a government. I see people advocating for that, but I think that really would cause a stir in West Virginia's business world and its perception. You've got to come to some deal, and there's got to be some compromise, I think. But where's the area of compromise people are willing to agree on? I don't know.
And the question is, how far will he push it? And who will bear the political costs and consequences of that if it does run out and we, you know, get to July 1 and there's some sort of shutdown or some other kind of chaos?
And I know, you know, some people are concerned that if we're going to raise regressive taxes on some people, it should be to keep basic investments going, not to pay for income tax cuts for those who are already pretty well off.
We're going to take a quick break. When we get back, more on the budget showdown. But first...
Hey, Scott Finn here, Executive Director of West Virginia Public Broadcasting. And yes, I am exhausted because we had a spectacular membership campaign. More than 1,000 people participated by calling 800-RADIO-87 or making a pledge online at wvpublic.org. Your membership is what protects the Front Porch and West Virginia Public Broadcasting. So if you are one of those 1,000 people, thank you. If not, the door is always open. We're always looking for new members. And the way you do that is go to our website, wvpublic.org, click the red donate button in the upper right-hand corner, and make yourself a member and say you did it for the Front Porch. Thanks.
And we're back. We've been talking about West Virginia's budget showdown, but I want to shift it now to Governor Justice in general. There was a big New York Times piece this past week about Governor Justice and his unique style. It mentioned the cow turd incident. It linked twice, Brad, to your reporting. What would you say his overall style has been? I mean, how has it been different from previous governors that you've seen?
I'd like to think that the New York Times article linked to my very insightful reporting on the state budget, but instead it was to articles about name-calling. But that's been a big part of the picture. So the first one was the governor was addressing highway supporters and boosters of those who want to improve the highway system. And he said early on in the legislative session, anyone who disagrees with this overall plan is a knucklehead. And he did it right in front of the Senate and House leadership. And that was a very different approach than you had seen out of Earl Ray Tomlin or Bob Wise or Cecil Underwood, anyone that I'm familiar with as governor. Very different. And then the other one was the much-talked-about characterization of the Senate majority leader as a poodle and himself as a grizzly. So the governor's got this way of talking that can be off-putting in cases to our other elected leaders and to those who support them, the constituents. So that has an effect on the politics of everything that's being discussed. And as we talk about this budget session, you don't want to think that policy is being discussed over name-calling, but it's got to have an effect. The other side of it, I would say, is the governor has a way of talking that is just like a regular person. And even though he's the billionaire owner of the Greenbrier, I think there's a certain segment of the population that finds it refreshing, entertaining. I can relate to that. That's the way I talk. It's got upsides and downsides, but that's the way he is.
What's your sense of how the people around him are perceived? Is it like Trump? Is it like he says these things and his staff kind of goes, oh no, and covers their eyes and scrambles? Or is it like, yeah, he's crazy like a fox. This is part of the plan.
Yes, I think of him, if you've watched the cartoons with the angel and the devil on the shoulder, he's got a certain segment of his staff that is very attuned to social media and communications. And I think they're seeing what Trump is doing and thinking about a new brand of politics and also what the governor's strengths as a communicator are. And I think that is, I don't know if it's the devil or the angel, but it's on one shoulder. And I think you've got another group on his shoulder that's more the traditional policy people, and these are the guys who are working with the legislature. And I think those are the guys who put their hands in their heads and go, oh boy, what a mess to clean up. The group that I described that's on the shoulder saying, let's make this splash, I think they are attuned to the community conversation and the social media and the reaction it's getting.
The contrast is amazing. Tomlin was all about no drama. Manchin was sort of about stage management, I think. And this one, I think one advantage of having someone like this is that people kind of watch and think, oh my God, what's going to happen next? So I think that does increase the fascination value. Then there's another question I feel like I have to bring up is what dog breeds would be considered compliments and which ones would be considered insults if you're referring to another politician as a kind of dog?
Yeah, a small squeaky dog, I think not.
Yeah, yip-yip dog, yeah.
Pit bull is probably good, right? Unless it's a woman, and then it's very uncomplimentary.
Great Pyrenees, probably top of the line.
That's one of the governor's favorite turns of phrase. Aside from the poodle comment, he likes to say that if you are not someone who would accept this great idea, you need to get yourself a dog because you need a friend. You were just so lonely out in the world. The only thing that could love you is a dog, is what the governor likes to say.
Okay. You do see a lot of his personal business experiences coming into play. And I think one place where that happened was his comment about the DEP inspectors. The idea was that they were not dressed appropriately. And we had an incident this week where he called the DEP inspectors here down to Charleston, and they went into an auditorium. We don't know exactly what was said. Is that right, Rick? Am I characterizing that?
Apparently,
right?
This was a story that came out in the Wednesday Gazette Mail. Like, all the inspectors were called into a meeting, and we don't know what the details were. It sounds like some of the tone of it was don't create problems for industry when they want to do something, we don't really know what was said. It's kind of an interesting thing. And you know, you might wonder what other, this hasn't happened in any other group. Like, they didn't call in CPS workers, for example, or people who work in other branches, highway people. So it's an interesting thing. Part of the dynamic is, I mean, to me, there's like an unwritten rule among that agency is you shouldn't inconvenience the rulers that much. And I think that point may have been emphasized here. I don't know.
We talked about his personality, and I think that's part of it. He's a guy who's used to being in charge, but he also can talk off the cuff, and he's got a really unique way of talking. So was that meeting meant to clarify what he had earlier said? Do those inspectors have a right to know what their biggest boss expects of them? But the other question I would have is, do we as citizens have a right to know also what is expected of them? Should there have been some more transparent way of saying what the biggest boss the state has is expecting of our state inspectors? I think it would be good to know, you know, if there's generally a change of policy, a change of attitude, shouldn't we know what it is?
Back to the big overall budget picture, some of the legislators have complained a little bit that we've come back too soon and that their brief right now isn't exactly clear. Do you think we'll actually get a budget out of this, or is there a chance that we'll have to come back and do this again? I mean, there's 2 months to go still before July 1st.
Yeah, there are a lot of options. The simplest option may be if the House just decides cut and dry, vote it down. A less clear possibility is the House begins to amend it when it's in their court. And do they nibble at it, or do they amend the whole thing and send it back to the Senate? And then another option potentially is to agree to disagree for the time being, let the rank and file go home, and let the leaders stay here in town and really work it out. I'd like to think that in the next couple of months we're going to find agreement somewhere, because people may theoretically think that a government shutdown is just what we need, but I think from a business perspective, from a societal perspective, from a state reputation perspective, there is no good outcome from shutting down your state government.
But is it the new normal? I mean, this is the second year that it's happened. This is the first year of his governorship. There's no sign that the legislature is going to go back to the Democratic Party. And, you know, is this what we can expect down the road with a Democratic governor and a Republican legislature?
I think part of this is setting us up for future years. It's the governor wanting the tools to pursue an ambitious agenda. His success and vision depends on the outcome here. And I think if it fails, or if it has a hard time succeeding, he then lays the blame on Republican lawmakers to say, these guys were obstructionists in 2018. Let's take care of this situation. I think particularly in the House, the Republican majority believes it was put in place to keep government in check. And I think they are laying the case for, from their point of view, the governor overreaching the bounds of what the government should be doing, from their point of view. And I think they are laying the argument for when they're up for election in a couple of years.
That's why in lieu of a Bible verse, I have a Bob Dylan verse this time, apropos of the situation. It's from the song Stuck Inside a Mobile with the Memphis Blues again. And here I sit so patiently waiting to find out what price we have to pay to get out of going through all these things twice. So here we go.
Can we have the Mormon Tabernacle Choir to sing You Can't Always Get What You Want?
There you go.
Hopefully not patiently waiting until July, and hopefully not going through all of it twice. And that's The Front Porch. Special thanks to Brad McElhaney, statewide correspondent for West Virginia Metro News. And hey, if you like The Front Porch, make sure you subscribe to our podcast so you'll never miss another week again. Thanks for listening.